This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which many episodes I will select kind of at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents, or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. After the season-long celebration of episode 100, we are restoring legacy numbering to the podcast because comic books. So for this 107th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we are looking at just one comic. I remember the good old days when we used to do that all the time. And that comic is Strange Adventures 243 from DC Comics, cover dated August-September 1973. But first, a little feedback from the pre-episode 100 era. Grant Richter wrote in on episode 95 on Sandman. Although I'm a few months behind and playing catch-up, again, I'm really enjoying your coverage of the Vertigo books on the Quarter Bin. I also missed the boat on Vertigo in the 90s, as well as the pre-Vertigo British invasion of the 80s. It wasn't until a few months ago, thanks in part to the Vertigo episode on Mike Gillis's Radio vs. the Martians, that I started taking a serious interest in the Vertigo line, specifically those titles that got their start on the darker fringes of the greater DC universe. I started, of course, with Swamp Thing, who I knew from my Marty Pascal stories of the early 80s, but I rapidly expanded my repertoire to include Hellblazer, the first Black Orchid miniseries, and Sandman with Books of Magic in the queue. While obviously I enjoy my favorite plant elemental the most, though he might not be the nicest guy in the world, but old Uncle Al sure can write him some touching romance interspersed with gruesome horror. The Master of Dreams is easily a close second. Thank you, Grant. Grant's blogging can be found at avatarofthegreen.blogspot.com. Also, I had a Twitter back and forth with Chris Ivey from the Kid to Flash podcast and the great Cans and Greg Arujo about episode 99. Not the story, not the issue, not Dr. Doom, but instead the statistics portion of that episode, where I talked about the publishers and the eras that had been most represented in those first 99 episodes of the Quarter Bin. Greg asked about the creators who have appeared most often on the show, and Chris Ivey simply demanded more statistics. So by popular demand, here are more statistics. These obviously discount the Mammoth episode 100, which was its own thing altogether. So here are some additional stats about the 117 books covered in the first 99 episodes of the podcast. First, let's start with characters. The characters who appeared most often on the podcast, either as the lead or the title character, or as a significant feature player, the number one character was, of course, Hail Doom. Dr. Doom appeared in a reasonable 16 comics that we covered. It drops pretty dramatically from there to 6 appearances, with 3 characters managing that feat: Doctor Strange, the Justice League taken as a single entity, and my longtime crush, the Scarlet Witch. Appearing in 5 episodes were Dr. Fate, Adam Strange, Loki, Thor, and The Thing. The big guys, Superman and Batman, appeared 4 times, along with the Micronauts. And then on Greg's question in particular, the writers, whose works have appeared most often on the podcast, no surprise if you think about it, John Francis Moore, His 14 appearances include 13 issues of Doom 2099. But Bill Mantlo made a really strong showing, writing 11 of the issues. And no surprise, Mike Grell wrote 7, Al Ewing and Roy Thomas wrote 5 each, and Marv Wolfman, and that kind of surprised me too, wrote 4 of these. In terms of artists, and here I'm throwing inkers and pencilers in together, and no surprise, again, the main men from Doom 2099 top that list as well. Pat Broderick did art on 14 of our issues, with John Nyberg doing 11. And after that, we get Rick Leonardi and the inking team of Aiken and Garvey at 6 each. Showing up 5 times as artists were Dick Giordano, Keith Giffen, and Lee Garbett. And the ones whose work appeared 4 times were Gray Morrow, Michael Davis, Dan Green, and the late Bernie Wrightson. And since we're here, talking about data, let me give you the briefest of statistical overview of the books that we actually did cover on episode 100. Those 100 comics break down by publisher as 42 DCs, 37 Marvels, and 21 Indies. Of the indies, Image had 3, First Comics had 3, Hero Comics actually had 2, Top Cow had 2, and then another dozen or so publishers had 1 comic each in that episode. In terms of the eras that the books came from, no surprise, 55 of the 100 books were from the 1990s, with another 34 from the 1980s. That leaves only 11. 7 of those were from the aughts, and 4 were from the 2010s. Thanks for that feedback, Chris and Greg. It was kind of fun digging back into the details of some of those issues. Well, we're sort of back to normal, with 1 issue, no guests, just like the good old days. So, I say, let's get straight to this. Strange Adventures 243, which, by the way, was the penultimate issue of this title, had an original cover price of 20 cents, meaning I paid... paid a 25% premium on that original cover price? This had better be good, that's all I'm saying. The cover of the issue shows. Well, I'm not actually sure what the cover of the issue shows because my copy doesn't have one. A cover, that is. But that's one of the sacrifices one makes when buying Bronze Age books from the quarter bin. Fortunately, this is an issue from the era in comics where the opening splash served as sort of a secondary cover. The story itself had its own intro page, so that cover, if you will, it shows Adam Strange in the foreground watching a weird-looking, upside-down, drill-like spaceship come in for a landing. And he is saying that the alien in that ship is his friend, and he will not stop him from destroying Ran. Now, the copy that I'm working from has a few unique aspects to it that really makes it one of a kind, and not just because it has no cover. Because I doubt that any other versions of Strange Adventures 243 have the name Randy Freeman scrawled across the top of the first page, which again actually serves as the cover, in black magic marker. To say nothing of the nice blue ink that I assume young Mr. Freeman used to fill in those pesky empty spaces in the two words Adam and Strange on the top of that page. So like I said, a pretty unique comic I'm looking at. There's only one little additional problem with it, and we'll get to that in a bit. I did check Mike's Amazing World to look at the actual cover of the issue, and allow me to describe that to you, because it is pretty cool. It shows a comparatively small Adam Strange towards the bottom of the cover firing a harpoon of some sort, not his traditional ray gun, into the mouth of a scary-looking, way larger than he is, white, I don't know, pterodactyl-looking bird thing. Adam's body is about the size of this creature's mouth. He would make a nice bite-sized snack. Great, dramatic, exciting cover by Nick Carty. The lead story, The Emotion Master of Space, originally appeared in Mystery in Space number 83 in May 1963. It was written by Gardner Fox, with art by Carmine Infantino and Murphy Anderson, all of whom are Silver Age standouts. We start on Earth with Adam Strange hovering above the Pacific Ocean, awaiting the Zeta Beam that will take him to Ran. But an underground volcano arises, potentially pushing him out of Zeta Beam range. But a little ray gun action, and he's back in the right place, and traveling once more to Ran. And upon arrival, he sees the love of his life, Alana. But hate contorting her lovely features, Alana draws her ray gun and fires at Adam. Fortunately, she has a woman's aim, so, you know, she missed him. I mean, only the extraordinary agility of her sweetheart saves his life. She proclaims that she hates him, hates him, hates him. I think she hates him. But it's not just his sweetheart. The entire city hates him. He heads out to the Misty Lands to regroup, and hears a distant mental voice taunting him. He finds the location of the voice, discovers a green alien and his Coildyne machine. This is the upside-down drill thing that I saw on the cover. It's actually a coil-like antenna that is sticking out way away from the body of the ship itself, the fuselage. This is the emotionizer, which can control the emotions of others. For instance, turning the entire population of Ranagar against him. Adam's weapons have no effect on this weapon or the alien himself. The alien emotionizes Adam into not fighting him, of thinking of the alien as a good friend. And then he explains his plan. I intend to shift Ran through space to a new orbital position about a star sun 500,000 light years away. The effects of the dreaded emotion machine wear off, and Adam is reunited with Alana for some huggy-huggies. She explains that the alien is named Lopau from the planet Lorraine. It told the people of Ran that on his homeworld, his people were virtually immortal, at least until a platinum Kalula bird from space arrived on the planet. The bird would come to Lorraine every 2 years to feast on the abundance of platinum on the planet, which caused it to give off radiation that was lethal to the people of Lorraine. Fearing that the creature would wipe out their race, they looked for a planet similar to Lorraine, with plenty of platinum as well, and they found Ran and organized a plot to switch places with it so the creature would destroy Ran instead. With Ran now in Lorraine's space, their world and its inhabitants are at risk. Finishing her story, the two lovers enter Alana's garden, where they find that her puppy has died from eating the Athetail plant. Synthesizing a poison from the plant that will affect the Kalula bird, Adam plans to coat all of the platinum on Ran with it, but it's too late to do so. So he attempts to harpoon the space bird with a dose of poison while it's still in space, but this plan also fails. And that's the point at which the version of the story in my specific issue ends. When I bought this from the good people, I mean that sincerely, at World's Greatest Comics, I knew it was coverless, obviously, but assumed it had a full story. But the middle page, those 4 pages of comic, which include the last 3 pages of this story, are missing. I don't blame Jeff or Keith for this. It's the first time I've bought a beat-up reader copy of a book from them that's actually missing a page. They pride themselves on only selling complete issues, no missing pages, even on the books with no covers. And their percentage of pulling that off has been 100% before I pick this one up, and I imagine it'll be 100% on every comic I pick up after this. bad break that the only time this has happened, it's for a podcast issue. But those are the breaks. Fortunately, there's a synopsis for this issue that I found on the DC Wikia. So here is their version of the ending of this story. Next, Adam has a fake Kalula bird lure the real one to eat a patch of poisoned platinum. The plan works, and the Kalula eats the poisoned platinum and dies. Soon after, the people of Lorraine hear of Adam killing the bird and contact Ran and explain that they had no such poisons to stop the bird on their world. In gratitude for killing it, the people of Lorraine return Ran to its original location in space. The end.
Adolescents this generation have no respect and are a far cry from my sweet Jane Eyre and her friend Helen Burns. Why, just this afternoon I was walking
Stella.
Across, and you know what? Men too. Well,
Stella?
Serious men like the tragic Mr. Rochester and teachers, Pa! They're all like the villainous Mr. Brocklehurst.
Hey, Stella!
Yes, Thomas?
As much as I enjoy indulging your insanity, we have a promo to record.
Oh dear, and what might that be?
That is you and I telling everyone that we have a brand new podcast out there. It's called Required Reading with Tom and Stella. Once a month, we will take a look at a single work of literature, discuss it, analyze it, and determine if it's worth its place in the canon.
Oh dear, that sounds delightful.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. And you can find us on the Two True Freaks Network, which is at twotruefreaks.com.
Oh yes, Required Reading with Tom and... Why is it Tom and Stella? Why can't it be Stella and Tom?
It rolls off the tongue better?
Okay.
Well, that was easy. So, Required Reading with Tom and Stella at twotruefreaks.com. Thanks for contributing to the promo there. You did a great job.
Oh, you are so welcome.
And we're back. Let's talk about this first story, and then we'll have a quick chat about the second story. I liked the drama of Alana shooting at Adam the moment he arrives. That was definitely an unexpected dramatic element. I mean, dames. Am I right? And there wasn't a lot, if any, of Sardath in the story. This is Alana's father, who at this point is just kind of a kooky mad scientist, but who later turns out to be a little more evil and conniving than we thought at the time. I liked the overall story, good, albeit goofy, sci-fi concepts. Yes, the cosmos is a much more delicate operating system than is portrayed here, and moving a planet a mere 500,000 light years away would be way more traumatic to that planet than is described here. The tides and atmosphere and all that would kill the inhabitants way before a platinum space bird would. And yes, platinum space bird. You know, if you have a problem with a platinum space bird being the main antagonist in a sci-fi story from the early 1960s, well then, maybe sci-fi stories from the early 1960s just aren't for you. And maybe, just maybe, that's actually part of the problem with Adam Strange. His shtick as a character, the ray gun and the jetpack and the sweetheart on another planet, it's just so of its era. And by era, I mean from the days of John Carter to the days of actual space exploration. I think that may be one of the unintended consequences of the space program. Traveling in space, actually going to the moon, if you believe that sort of thing, the existence of an international space station. All of these things may have taken the wonder out of space, given us more of a grounding, a reality in space. And that makes this type of story out of step. It immediately makes it out of date. Not that space-based sci-fi is over, but it's become weirdly more realistic, or at least maybe more plausible. To the layman, less fantastic. I'm thinking of the movies like Moon or Gravity. as opposed to Flash Gordon, or John Carter, or Adam Strange. I wonder if this is at least part of what's going on with the Fantastic Four, also. There are obviously corporate conflicts as well, but I wonder if they have maybe outlived their welcome, at least as Marvel's first family. Their initial power-causing flight happens, based on the sliding Marvel timeline, after 9/11. So they aren't space pioneers. There's something else. That can certainly be written around, but it necessitates a change to their origin, that they aren't going to be the recognizable characters they were in the 60s, 70s, and 80s to make them work in the 2010s. I don't know. Certainly Adam Strange fits this category, along with a couple other of my favorites, like the Challengers of the Unknown and the Metal Men. Somehow the Doom Patrol have escaped this fate, but I think that is just incredibly inventive writers, having changed their shtick to just be the weirdest part of DC, other than the sci-fi-est part of DC. But these are all concepts that I love, but I'm not sure that they have futures in comic books, at least in month-in, month-out characters that can carry a title for an extended time. And I know, that is kind of a bummer. But back to this story. I can see some people having a problem or two with it, actually on the same subject. The key clue that Adam uses to formulate his poison is the death of a pet dog. And if you don't see that coming, it could be troubling. It's an emotional beat. It's a good beat to the story. But I wonder if a comic story today would write around that fact somehow. Maybe something as simple as the dog getting really sick but recovering, still serving this important plot function, but not dying. And similarly, killing the space bird. He's pretty cavalier about that. Certainly doing some greater good sort of math. One bird versus an entire planet of humanoids. But I wonder if that would also generate some controversy. But as a story for what it was, when it was, and for not having the three last pages of the story, I thought this was fine. It was an interesting plot. Interesting villains, two villains actually, the alien and the space bird. A science-based resolution, come on, you know what I mean, and a happy ending. What more could you want? Go Adam Strange. This was a 15-page story, although, as I said, I only had the first 12, and there was an 8-page backup. And although it sadly does not feature Adam Strange, we'll nonetheless spend a few minutes with it. The second story in this issue is Emperor of Earth, which originally appeared in Strange Adventures 131 back in August 1961. It was written by Gardner Fox with art by Murphy Anderson. The story starts with this dramatic proclamation over a cover page of the story of two men, one dressed much more traditionally Earth-like than the other, and they're battling on flying beasts. And this is the quote we have. We fought, a mile above the ground, in a land no man had ever heard of, on flying creatures that nobody knew existed. If I won the fight with Zagor, I would save the lives of a billion people. But if he won, he would rule the Earth. The narrator is Kenneth Carey, science editor for a Midwestern newspaper. Sent to Paris to cover a convention of nuclear physicists, he finds himself drawn to a jewelry store. In a window there, he finds a scarlet stickpin diamond that exactly matches the one he wears, one that was a family heirloom. He notices that they match exactly, as if made to join together. As the two pieces touch, deep in their crystalline depths, he saw an incredible, beautiful face. Kenneth! Hurry to me, and lest you come quickly, Jagar will destroy the world. She mentally guides Kenneth Carey to Brazil, to a slope in the Andes Mountains, and the native guides refuse to go any further. Their superstitious beliefs prove true, as griffins, half-eagle, half-lion beings, swoop him up the mountain, where he meets Lyra, the girl he saw in the diamond. Her ancient people, the people of Zaldaron, were once a peace-loving scientific community whose people discovered a wandering planet that would change the rotation of Earth's axis, which would move the tropical land of Xandarone into the South Pole. The majority of the people rested in suspended animation, while the scientific leaders created a machine that would turn the Earth's axis back. The two matched diamonds were needed to run the machine, but Kenneth's ancestor Kenoth ran away from the land with them. Zagor attempted to use fake diamonds to run the machine, but it exploded. Only Zagar and Lyra survive, and Zagar is fixated on trying to use the fake diamonds to run the machine again, but if he does, and it explodes again, that could be disastrous to the entire world. But Zagor rips the stick pin from Kenneth's hand and is off on one of the nearby griffins. Kenneth mounts the other beast, and they have a pretty good airborne fight. The reporter manages to knock Zagar away from his machine, and he falls into an open pit and is assumed dead. Then, as Lyra and Kenneth fly away to his world, a huge explosion rumbles beneath them. Look, Zagar must have climbed back and tried to use his duplicate jewels. He's caused a frightful earthquake. And then in the final panel, we've jumped several years into the future, where Lyra and Kenneth, now married, talk about the possible discovery of her land beneath the Arctic ice. Xandarone is still there, waiting to be reborn. Now again, that's not a bad sci-fi story. No heroes this time, just a compelling, albeit somewhat familiar story, at least one with familiar elements. There's definitely a John Carter vibe going on here. The hero from another land, rescuing the beautiful queen and all that. Huge beasts, mid-air battles. It even ends with marriage. It has all the things that a classic Silver Age story should have, and it worked for me. I do want to bring up one topic here, one aspect that this story really brought to mind for me. We need to discuss the overused and often improperly used literary term, the Mary Sue. To me, by the way, this is a gender-neutral term. There are other male-sounding names that some folks use for this, but Mary Sue is fine for me, for men and women. Women have long been included in male-sounding collective nouns, so this is one where we guys can compromise. And a male character can be a Mary Sue, if the term fits. A Mary Sue is an idealized fictional character that is often recognized as an author insert or wish fulfillment. I say all of that to say this. Kenneth Carey is a classic Mary Sue. The first clue is that the character is a writer. Anytime a writer writes about a writer, my antennae go up, and I'm on the lookout for author insertion. And in this case, this writer character is drawn to a particular area, a store, in this case, and then is contacted by a beautiful princess, is led to an ancient civilization, rides griffins, and has an airborne griffin dogfight, actually gets in a couple of good punches on the evil would-be ruler of the world, and escapes with the princess. And they marry and live happily ever after. To me, this is the textbook definition of the author insert wish fulfillment story, or as that type of story or character has come to be termed, a Mary Sue. Now, the presence of a Mary Sue in a story doesn't make the story bad, by the way, automatically. Just like a little bit of telling, not showing, every now and then doesn't disqualify a story from being good if you're critiquing it from a literary perspective. And this one was pretty good. Not terribly original, but solid. There's a reason that these elements reappear regularly in sci-fi and fantasy stories. It's because they work. The verdict on Strange Adventures 243, even without a cover, without 3 pages of story, and with a backup without Adam Strange, I still like this. The problem is, I doubt you can find a with-cover version of this for a quarter. But the one I got, even with its myriad issues and problems, is definitely worth a quarter. I'm counting this, with all its problems, 25 cents well spent. And as you know, I do not say that lightly. Well, that wraps up my coverage of Strange Adventures 243, or at least as much of it as I have, bringing episode 107 to a close. In episode 108, we'll be covering Marvel Team-Up 144, starring Moon Knight and Spider-Man, I guess. From Marvel Comics, cover dated August 1984. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the episodes, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.